So today, we're going to start talking about a different area of machine learning known as unsupervised learning. So far we've talked about these supervised learning tasks where we have labels. Today we're going to start looking at what we can do when we have unlabeled data. I also just want to note that tomorrow we had to exchange the time for the lecture with the string theory lecture. So the lecture will still take place here, but it'll be at 10:15 a.m. till 11:15. Note that just for the one day, then we'll be back to this schedule on Thursday. So we'll talk about a few different things today. First of all, we'll just talk about different things you can do using unsupervised learning because it's a fairly broad field. Then we'll actually talk about its relationship to supervised learning, so kind of how we can think of a relationship between the two. And then we're going to talk about a specific thing we can do with unsupervised learning called dimensional reduction. And we'll actually talk about this today and tomorrow. Today we'll look at a technique called principal component analysis, and then we'll look at another method tomorrow. Okay, so as you guys might remember from, I guess, the first lecture, or maybe I mentioned it other times, kind of a broad way to state the goal of unsupervised learning is that we want to learn some about the structure or the features of data that doesn't have labels. So we're going to write our data set with this curly D notation as a set of points X. And just to be really clear, we're going to talk about kind of two different lengths that we can use to describe our data. So one is the number of components in our data, or the dimensionality of our data set. But then we can also talk about how many samples we have, or how many data points in our data set. So that's going to end up being, I don't know, sometimes I find it can get a bit confusing. We're going to put these elements in a matrix. So just maybe remember N is components, M is number of samples. OK, and as I said, there's a lot of things we can try to do with unsupervised learning. But in this class, we're going to kind of look at two classes of algorithms that we can do. Okay, so the first one, we'll call that dimensional reduction. And we're going to look at that today and tomorrow, as I said when I talked about the outline. And the idea of dimensional reduction is that we want to take our data set, which has dimension n, and n might be very large. We want to try to see if we can come up with a new way of describing this data in a lower dimensional space, which will probably result in losing some information, but maybe we can keep most of the essential features and structure of our data in doing that. And so we can have a more efficient lower dimension representation. So we can kind of think that we're taking our dimensionality n, and we're coming up with a new representation with dimensionality n prime, but that should be smaller. And one reason we might want to do this is, I mean, there's many reasons. It's just a more efficient representation of our data. But another advantage is that if this n prime is just 1, 2, or 3, then we can actually visualize our data. So what we're going to see is that when we look at examples where we try to reduce our data down to 3 or 2 or 1 components that are the most important, when we plot our data in this visual way, our data will naturally form clusters in many points, in many cases. So what we know, if we think of the example of icing spin configurations, for example, what do you think is a really important feature for us to learn? So we want to learn the most important features of our data. So what's something that would be really important to learn? I heard like some, I can't quite make out what anyone said.
If the configuration is ordered or not.
Right, so we want to figure out this notion of order, so maybe learning the order parameter. So we already know, based on our physical knowledge of the icing model, that magnetization is important. But maybe we're not going to tell these algorithms that magnetization is important. And we're going to see that algorithms, when we look at some lower dimensional representation, they're actually going to be able to kind of divide the data into clusters that have to do with their magnetization. Thank you. So this is just one case that we might see. We might see something like this, where if we look at the most important features of our data, they somehow encode the magnetization in some way. So that we'll often see that if we divide up icing configurations and we study their dimensional reduction, we might get three clusters. Two for the paramagnetic phase, whether we're up or down. Sorry, two for the ferromagnetic phase and one for the paramagnetic phase. Questions about that? So we're going to look at one algorithm for doing this in the tutorial on Thursday. So again, the tutorials this week are a little bit behind the lectures just because of the way the PSI schedule was. So we'll do a tutorial on supervised learning with convolutional neural networks today, and we'll look at this dimensional reduction in Thursday's tutorial. Okay, so dimensional reduction was one task that we're going to study in this course. And the other type of task that we'll look at is generative modeling. And that's going to be next week. So basically all of next week is going to be about generative modeling. So you're going to have 5 lectures on it next week, but just to kind of give you an idea of what it is. So the idea of generative modeling is that we want to take our data and somehow have an algorithm learn about the probability distribution that underlies those data points and describes it. And then we want to have a mechanism for generating new samples from that probability distribution. And there's lots of different algorithms for doing this, as we're going to talk about. And they each have different advantages, and they each kind of attack this problem in different ways. OK, so again, I'm not going to talk about that too much because it's going to be all of next week. But I just wanted to kind of outline how the rest of the how these 7 lectures on unsupervised learning are going to go. And then Thursday, Friday this week, we'll have lectures on reinforcement learning, which is the third area of machine learning we're going to look at. So something that's pretty neat is that even though up until now we've always been saying that supervised learning is very distinct from unsupervised learning, it turns out there's a relationship between the two of them that kind of allows us to formulate problems in either case that we want to, in either kind of terminology that we might want to. So what I just said in words over here is that for unsupervised learning, what we want to do is we want to take a data set and we want to learn its underlying distribution. And a way that we could phrase the problem of supervised learning, we know that we want to take a data set and we want to somehow learn to describe our labels in terms of some input data. And we can actually think of that as learning a conditional probability distribution. So given some input x, what is the probability that the label is y? That's essentially what we're trying to learn in supervised learning. But we can apply the chain rule to describe probability distributions in terms of conditional distributions. And this actually means that these two problems are really the same in the end. One of them can be composed in terms of other problems from the other class. So if I have a variable with n components, then I can decompose it in this way, in terms of a product of two probabilities. And I can keep doing this. And I see that I can write the problem of expressing this probability distribution for this variable with n components in terms of several conditional probabilities which correspond to supervised learning problems. So what we see here is really that this unsupervised learning problem for learning data that was n-dimensional reduces to n minus 1 supervised learning problems. And then we also have to learn this last distribution corresponding to just one component. But that's a lot easier than learning a higher dimensional problem. And for example, if we just think of our icing model or any case with Z2 symmetry, what would I expect to find for the distribution of just one spin if I was looking at configurations that had this symmetry? So I just want to know the distribution of, if I pick any, basically any site at random due to translational invariance, the probability that it's up or the probability that it's down. If I have this symmetry, there, what is it going to be? Exactly, 50-50, right? If I have this symmetry and I know my configurations are independent, then half of the time my first first spin should be up, half the time it should be down. So maybe it's not always so easy. Maybe we don't always know this by physical reasoning what it is, but it would be easier to learn than learning an n-dimensional distribution. Do you guys have questions so far? Yeah?
Sorry, what's the index on the lower line and the product in the last?
Oh, here? This is I minus 1. I'll rewrite it. And this is 2, I equals 2 to n.
Okay, then.
Yeah. Any other questions? So this, what I just described here, was taking an unsupervised learning problem and expressing it in terms of supervised learning problems. But we can actually go the other way around, too. So by using this expression that probabilities satisfy, we can show that a supervised learning problem can be expressed only in terms of problems corresponding to unsupervised learning. And so various algorithms that we're going to see for doing generative modeling, for example, are going to exploit these relationships between these different problems. Even though, I mean, maybe for what we're going to talk about, it might not be absolutely necessary to think about that the fact that your unsupervised learning problem is really several supervised learning problems. But I think it's just really good to keep in mind that these classes are really not as distinct as we might think they are. Any questions? Yeah.
So in case when you are expressing the supervised learning problem in terms of the unsupervised learning, so in the unsupervised learning, we are learning the joint probability distribution.
In which case? In the unsupervised, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so we would kind of group the X and Y to form like the data set for the unsupervised learning. So we would be learning the joint distribution, yeah. Okay, so now we're going to talk about a specific algorithm for doing dimensional reduction, which is probably the simplest algorithm we can study, and it's called principal component analysis, or PCA. Thank you. So the idea of principal component analysis is that we're going to generate this lower dimensional representation that is common to all dimensional reduction techniques. But the specific way we're going to do that is through a linear transformation. So PCA is actually not always useful, but I want to just kind of show you visually an example of a case where it would be useful. So if these are the coordinates corresponding to my data, and I see that my data points basically fall on a line, this would mean that my coordinate x2 is highly linearly correlated with my data point x1. So that knowing x1 is enough to have a good guess of what x2 should be. So again, because these data points are very highly correlated, if I know one of the components, I have a really good guess of what the other one is going to be. And so PCA would kind of identify this linear correlation, as we'll see. We're going to see this more clearly through example, but I just want to emphasize that this is not always useful. Sometimes there might be very strong correlations in our data, but they might not be linear. And in that case, PCA is not going to be a very good choice of method. And we're going to have to use other methods like the ones that we're going to look at tomorrow. Questions at all? Okay. So we're going to store all of our data for all of the components and all of the samples that we have in a matrix. So this is the matrix that we're going to form from all of our m by n data points or coordinates that we have. And just an important note to make is that when we do PCA, the formulas, the expressions I'm going to show you, are going to assume that the mean value of every coordinate averaged over all samples is zero. So first we're going to shift the mean just in case we have cases where the mean is not zero. In our cases, if we're looking at these examples with Z2 symmetry, we would kind of expect that on average these coordinates would average to zero, but they might not for the specific samples that we have. So we have to first shift this mean. So that's what this amounts to, is basically taking all of our data points and shifting by the mean of all of our data, or I can think of applying that to each element by averaging over the columns. And just to remind you, I iterates over our m different data points, and j iterates over the n component. You guys can think if you have any questions while I erase the board. Any questions? So now I'm going to define a new n by n matrix. And the entries of this matrix are going to give me information about the variances and covariances in my data. So the diagonal elements here, if you just kind of look at how you would get a diagonal element, it would be by taking the transpose of this matrix, so the transpose of one of those lines that you see in that matrix expression. And you'd see that you would get the exact formula that describes the variance of one of the components of your data points. Thank you. So if we look at the off-diagonal elements, those are going to tell you the covariance between different pairs of our components. So maybe between component 1 and component n of our data or something like that. We'll see what the covariance is. So this is really a measure of how the data is correlated between different components. So what I now want to do is I want to apply some linear transformation to my coordinates, which are stored in the matrix X. So P corresponds to the specific linear transformation I'm going to do to my data. And I'd like to do it in such a way that the new representation X prime that I have is diagonal. So all the covariances will be 0. The components will be uncorrelated. And the diagonal components will store how much my data varies along these different components. Okay, so now let's see how we can kind of express all of these different matrices in terms of each other. So let's consider this covariance matrix for this new representation, X prime, that I know I want to be diagonal. So what I see is that I can express this covariance matrix in terms of the covariance matrix I had for my original coordinates if I include and incorporate this transformation P. And if this matrix is diagonal, then what I'm going to find is that I can just express this, I can set this expression equal to some diagonal matrix D. Okay, and just one note is that since this covariance matrix for the original coordinates is symmetric, it means that its eigenvalues can be chosen in such a way that they're orthogonal, and that means the inverse of P is just going to be its transpose. And what that means is that all this PCA really is, it's an eigenvalue problem. And if we kind of look at the expression for what our eigenvalues would have to be in terms of this new representation x prime, we see that it's a sum of squares of these coordinates, which are still going to be real valued coordinates. And so we see that every eigenvalue is going to be positive. Okay, and now I kind of want to think about which of these new components are most important. And it turns out that I can determine which ones are most important just by looking at these eigenvalues, lambda. So now I have a concept of the first principal component. It's going to correspond to the component x1 prime after I've applied the transformation in this way. And we see what it really means to look at the largest eigenvalue. It means looking in the direction from your original data with the highest variance. So what this sort of means in PCA, in this data that I've drawn, I would want to find the direction where my data is changing with the highest variance. So that would be this direction in this case. And my x2 prime direction would be the other direction here. So we can think of the directions with the variance we want to keep and we want to continue to study. So the principal components that we keep will be our signal, and we're going to treat the other components, which we will discard, as noise. Any questions? Okay, so last thing I want to say. Is that it's important to consider the magnitude of these eigenvalues relative to each other. So let's say we plotted our eigenvalues for a system and we got something like this. We would see that these eigenvalues are decaying quite quickly. And what this would really mean is that it's fairly safe for us to only keep the first few principal components, and we would still retain a lot of the important features of our data. Okay, so it's a long sentence, but I think it's important, so I wrote it all down. So the idea is that if we get to a point where these eigenvalues are small, It means that we could basically ignore the principal components corresponding to those eigenvalues, and we would still have a fairly valid and efficient representation of our original data. So in this case, if I didn't look at the principal components 4 through n and I only kept the first 3, I would expect that I would still retain a lot of the important information that differentiates my data points and the important features encoded in that data. So a couple more things to say, but any questions? Yeah.
So this only works for linear correlations.
Yeah.
Can you try transforming the data to, logarithmically or whatever to see?
Yeah, so tomorrow we're going to look at a completely different way of doing this that's non-linear. So I can... So the method we're going to look at tomorrow is called TISNE, T-S-N-E. And I'll write what it stands for tomorrow, just in case I have it wrong. I think it's T-distributed stochastic neighbor embedding. So this is going to be a new method that we'll study tomorrow that's going to apply nonlinear transformations to our data. And so again, I want to return to the really important point that this PCA method can be really useful if you have linear correlations in your data, but lots of times you're not going to have linear correlations. And so that's really what's going to tell you whether this method is going to be successful or not. Yeah, question?
So unlike with the supervised learning, there's not really like an iterative component here?
There's no iterative component here. Some unsupervised methods still do. In the generative modeling, we will see, and it actually tomorrow too, the TSNE does, but this algorithm, no, it doesn't have an iterative component.
So different from the other one, it's hard to see how they're related.
I know, yeah, so this is very different. Yeah, so I'd say really today and tomorrow's lecture are almost somewhat independent from what we've seen so far. So it's really a very different kind of method, although actually tomorrow maybe today even more so than tomorrow, because this method really doesn't use any of this iteration that we developed in the first week. But I think it's really interesting to show because we're going to study similar data using this method. So in homework 1, you guys are studying Ising model configurations using these fully connected feed-forward neural networks, and we're going to look at the exact same data using PCA in tutorial 4. So even though the methods are really different, you'll kind of see they allow us to get different insights into the same data. So I think that's cool. Yeah, question?
If either M is very large or N is very large, would one still implement that exactly, or is it too complex?
Oh, yeah, good question. Yeah, I guess there's methods where you can just look at, probably you can just get the first few eigenvalues, and then that would be iterative, I guess, right? If you want to just, there's methods that exist where you can just kind of get the largest eigenvalue and then the second largest eigenvalue. And I think it's not exact, but then that would have that iterative component to it.
So if n is very large, we'll not do that?
I think so, yeah. In the tutorial, we're just going to do it exactly. But I think that's what people would do, yeah. They would just look at the first few eigenvalues in that case. And I guess, I mean, another way you could maybe introduce some iteration is maybe you could, again, divide your data into batches if M was too big. So instead of considering our whole data set, maybe we could just look at the principal components corresponding to just some mini batch of them, just like in stochastic gradient descent. So again, I've never done that, but it just came to me as you were asking these questions about iterative methods and then also about what you do when your data set is huge. So I think we could consider looking at a smaller set of our data and then consider how well that generalizes to describing other elements of our data set. Any other questions? Yeah?
Do you want M to be much, much larger than N for this to work well?
OK.
Because if like in 2D space, if I
right.
have 2 points, I can always draw a line.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Probably, yeah. I guess, yeah. It would also depend on the nature of your data, how much noise you have. But yeah, in general, you would expect that if M was too small, you would have a lot of issues with identifying your principal components, for sure. Yeah, that's a good point. Although, I'm just thinking about, maybe we can try it in the tutorial. We can, because in the icing, maybe before I answer that question fully or say a bit more, if we think of the icing model, do you guys think this would work well or not work well? This PCA method.
Your data is a configuration, or what is your?
Sorry, your data is just your spin configurations. Yeah, the order parameter is just linear for the icing model, right? All we do is we sum our components. And so we are actually going to expect that just looking at the first principal component for the icing model is going to do a very good job in this case. Yeah, question.
If you have like a high dimensional data set where it's hard to visualize it or like plot it somehow, like in what useful cases do you know that the data points are linearly correlated so that you can use this method?
No, you wouldn't necessarily know. So what you would do is
try it and see if it works.
Well, you would try it and you would look at your eigenvalues. And if you saw something like this where they're decaying quickly, it would mean that there are linear correlations. And if you saw that all of the eigenvalues were flat, for example, so they just weren't changing, they weren't really getting much smaller, then that would mean there's not really strong linear correlations in your data, and you really need all of those principal components to describe your data. Okay. So that's going to happen with the gauge theory data, because the order parameter there is not linear. So there, we can't really truncate any of our principal components if we want to look at the gauge theory. So we'll see that. We can try that in the tutorial, too. You'll see that if you try to take away any of them, you just won't be able to describe the features of your data because this spectrum is just flat.
So with this method, you might try it and it just wouldn't work and then you would move on to something else.
Yeah, but you would kind of, I think you'd have an indication that it doesn't work because you would see that this eigenvalue spectrum is fairly flat. And then you'd say, okay, I need to use something like this TSNE. I can try that or I can try something else. Yeah. But just returning to your question about whether M needs to be big, you're probably right. I'm just trying to think of whether it actually needs to be on the order of N, just because in the icing model, I would think if it was a very long spin chain, if I just gave a few examples where it was ordered and not ordered, I think it might work. So M would be small, but N could still be large. So we can actually try it in the tutorial, and we'll see.
Thinking of 2D and 3D.
Yeah, okay.
You can get any line, you can get any surface.
Right.
I don't know
if
it keeps going.
But I guess the idea is that in if we're thinking of 3D, we're not thinking of any surface, right? We're only thinking of linear correlation. So that restricts us a lot. So yeah, we'll try it out and we'll see how it works. Or I can try to read a bit more about that too to see the actual bounds on when it works. Yeah.
So would this be used as like a way to pre-process the data before, say, feeding it into the neural network or something?
Sure. Yeah. You can do that for sure. So yeah, you can imagine in lots of cases we saw that networks were difficult to train when the data sets were too big, and so this is basically reducing the dimensionality of your data set, right? Yeah, so that's definitely could be used in pre-processing. Yeah, that's a really good point. Anything else? Okay, cool. So we're gonna have tutorial this afternoon on CNNs, that's at 2. And then there's this colloquium at UW, I think I sent you guys about it. If any of you are interested in going, we can walk there after. It's not part of the course, but I think it'll be a really good colloquium. And he's going to probably talk about quantum machine learning. So that'll be interesting. That's the UW colloquium at 4:15, I think. And then just reminder, tomorrow the lecture's at 10:15 instead of 9, just for one day. And then Thursday we're back to 9 o'clock. Okay, see you guys this afternoon.